5 minutes after 10, and thank you so much for staying with us. This hour, we are in conversation with former Finance Minister Pravin Gordhan, who is here with us in the studio, and you can take part in this conversation as well. Tweet us your questions for him. Use the hashtag Pravin on Eusebius, or use the handles that you can tag at Radio 702, at Eusebius, at Cape Talk. It's going to be a wide-ranging conversation, and I'm grateful, Mr. Gordhan, that you have honored, of course, a commitment going back to Lily's leave. We said we'd have another chat, a longer one in studio. Thank you so much for coming in.
No, thank you for having me. I'm sure we'll have an interesting time because we live in interesting times.
We absolutely do. And a lot of people excited about this. Sibu Siso tweeting that, oh, you've got in the studio. He says, "Oh, babes, woku joiner ama dots." That's exactly what we're going to do. We're going to be joining the dots. I want to start by talking about corruption. Sadly, we're not short of problems in this country. We've got a shopping list. Everything from deep inequality, unemployment, low levels of economic growth. And they're obviously interrelated in many ways. But in that list, how important is it in particular for us to get a grip on the nature and the scope of corruption?
No, quite important, because firstly, we come from a very corrupt past, which more recent books and literature and research is revealing. The nature of the apartheid state, how it actually operated, many of the corrupt practices that were, in a sense, embedded in our society generally, but perhaps even in the business sector as well, particularly during the sanctions busting era, when extraordinary, inverted commas, things needed to be done in order for business to survive and cope. The second reason is we don't have too many fiscal resources. We are constrained by all the factors that you've mentioned and have huge responsibilities for government to play a leading and constructive role in the development and reconstruction of South Africa. And for them to do that, you need the cash. So there were good times in the 2000s, or some of the those years until the Great Recession, when resources were available, we used them by and large in an appropriate kind of way. And what corruption does ultimately in the current period, as it would have done anywhere else in the world, is take away resources that the poor should get access to, take away resources from investment, which is quite an important component in stimulating growth, which itself will then generate jobs in our country. But I think that a conversation that needs to be had is the relationship between corruption as a mindset, corruption as a practice, and corruption as part of an overall system that is operating across the world today, where the focus is on quick bucks, so to speak, getting rich quickly by whatever means, the role of the financial sector in actually exacerbating that problem, and imbalances within the global economy and our own economy between the financial sector and the real economy, as we actually call it. And how does this search for yield by businesses, the quest for higher salaries and bonuses that actually need to be paid, generate a mindset and a set of practices that then become endemic? Is a question to ask.
There's been a stereotype for many decades that the public sector has a monopoly on corruption. What we are seeing currently in South Africa is our own version of coming to terms with something that's always probably been true, which is that corruption requires two to tango, and invariably that requires corrupt relationships between private sector players and someone willing to be corrupted within the public sector. And suddenly you have these global brands like McKinsey consulting firm or KPMG auditing that are suddenly being shown up, despite the fact that someone can be numerate, can have a degree from a UCT, can be financially literate, can arrive in a suit. It doesn't mean that they are necessarily less susceptible or less capable of stealing from society. What are your reflections of the number of private sector players, including McKinsey and KPMG, that has surfaced in the larger narrative of state capture?
Well, again, it fits in with what I've just said, which is how do I increase the sort of bottom line and the profitability of either my particular project or my business as a whole. Secondly, dependent on that profitability will be my reward, either in the form of bonuses or in salaries as well, and might even be shares and so on that go with that. And thirdly, what lines am I willing to cross in order to ensure that I can accumulate this wealth and accumulate it as quickly as possible? Together with that, in a country like South Africa, but I think elsewhere as well, you have peer pressure. What car are you driving? What car am I driving? What house are you living in? What house am I living in? So how do we keep up with the Joneses, so to speak, which I think is part of the consumerism that is infecting South Africa, but also the rest of the world within the economic system as well. So what we find is that on the boards and on, in the publications of many entities, including the public sector, you know, this is our value system, this is our integrity code on the one hand, but the behaviors in the context of what I've just described can be a complete contrast with what is on paper, so to speak. And so the question is, what's the culture that is being generated in these institutions?
Yes.
What kind of leadership is actually being given? And which kind of leadership says, no, you shall not cross that line. We rather not do that business than actually engage and practice X, Y, Z. And what kind of leadership will say, I'm going to look the other way as long as my numbers look good at the end of the day?
Which raises an obvious question around organizational culture. When the rot has set in deep, whether it be the organizational culture of a political party or a company, how does one reverse that? And I want us to take a concrete example. Let's not run away from it. Take, for example, KPMG. The country is grappling with the question of what the appropriate incentive structures are, or retribution or consequences for evidence of unethical auditing practices that have surfaced. And some people are of the view that, in fact, their license should be revoked, that ideally they should go under, because the one thing that really focuses shareholders are when you see consequences for the bottom line. Would it be useful for a big company like a McKinsey or KPMG to fall, to close? Because then it sends the message unambiguously that South Africa is not a country where looting and being in cahoots with corrupt politicians and public servants will maximize shareholder value.
Well, look, in that context, the example of Enron and Arthur Andersen, the fifth of the big five as they existed in the past, is always a very useful reference point as to what could happen if you get things completely wrong, as happened in that particular relationship. But secondly, it also is a very good example of how quickly that snowball effect, where you begin to gather negativity at a speed faster than you can actually manage. Although, you know, we all heard subsequently about shredding of documents, et cetera, and how the negative effect of total destruction of a company can actually take place. In the case of KPMG, I think that's the tension that we have to deal with. On the one hand, a lesson needs to be learned. And the regrettable thing, I think, about the South African leadership of KPMG is that, if we use our local parlance, they were ducking and diving, so to speak, for far too long, rather than as good, strong leaders confronting some of the issues that were in the public domain virtually throughout 2015 and 2016, and taking a moral and ethical stance on some of those issues, whether it's in relation to SARS or the other issues that we were actually dealing with. It's only when the email stuff came out that you now suddenly had to have this excruciation that they're actually undergoing. At the same time, it's not out of order to actually raise questions about what happens to the 3,500 people. The one view could be that they get absorbed in other parts of the industry, that medium-sized businesses can actually grow, that you actually then change the big three or big four into a big 10, which is one of the big issues, as you know, in most economies, the highly concentrated nature of certain sectors of the economy, which leads to oligopolistic practices, which leads to price setting and collusion, and which leads to negative effects for medium and small-sized businesses at the end of the day. So coming back to KPMG, I'm still undecided about which way to go. Safe to say that I think the corporate sector taking the lead from BLSA and the kind of measures that they've taken last week needs to send out a very, very strong message that we really can't have auditors like yourselves unless you can demonstrate to us that you've undergone a fundamental change in culture. And then, as you correctly raised the question, how long does it take to get that kind of change in culture? And what kind of leadership is actually required to change culture within an organization?
You've already pointed out publicly, Mr. Gordon, that the very short statement from KPMG, a couple of pages that it runs into, is woefully inadequate. KPMG then had a meeting with you, and I am baffled knowing your pedigree, your integrity, what on earth they must have tried to persuade you of, when one of the things they did not persuade you of, clearly, given your subsequent public statements, is a willingness to be far more precise and granular in telling the country what it is that they are confessing to.
Well,
what happened in that meeting?
No, as our statement said, let me clarify the purpose of the meeting. As courteous South Africans, we were quite obliging to the request I had from the international chairperson, whose term of office, by the way, expires on the 30th of September, and a new gentleman takes over. So it was as a courtesy to hear them. But secondly, to make it very clear, as you point out, that we want to know the facts. So it's now very much in the public domain that if you take the SARS issues, the terms of reference were changed two or three times. Individuals were being, in fact, targeted. We all now know about the cutting and pasting from a legal memo onto the KPMG report. And like that, what else is there that, in fact, any firm with any integrity would not have done in those circumstances? And the second is to point out to them that this is not just an isolated technical matter, that you've got to see this particular set of misdemeanors on their part, both in terms of the companies that they audited, but also the institution like SARS as well, in terms of their involvement there, must be seen in the context of the state capture phenomenon in South Africa. And that, in fact, they were willing partners, so to speak. Maybe they didn't realize the magnitude of what they were doing, but for a fee, they were willing partners in a state capture project, as were many others.
When you put that perspective to them, were they partial to that view, or did they resist it? I mean, it seems trite to me as a South African, as a citizen, but I'd love to know how they responded to that.
No, I think that we opened certain windows for them on the international side to look at themselves far more carefully. And hopefully even the South African leadership that is now in place understands that the technical work can't be separated from the context in instances like the ones that we are talking about. There will be instances where the technical is satisfactory, but in these situations, what we must be very clear about is that the state capture agenda is alive, it's well, it's persistent, it's resilient, and it's moving every single day. And that it is in the interest of South Africans and civil society organizations, and indeed political organizations, to ensure that we understand this phenomenon and wherever possible, trip it. Stop it if we can actually have the capacity to do so.
One of the things that I found odd about KPMG, and I've just got two more questions on this subject and then we'll move on, is their idea of how to cost economically the impact of their unethical behavior. So there was a preparedness in the statement they'd released to pay the amount that they had gained for the unethical services that they had rendered, and for any other work done in relation to the Guptas. But then I think to myself, if you have decent accounting practices, which clearly they don't, you would know that you're actually undercounting the overall economic, quite apart from the political economy impact of their behavior. What are your thoughts on that? Would you agree with me? And how would you characterize what the true cost society has been of KPMG's behavior?
Yeah, I know. I think their offer to pay back 23 million rands plus 40 was gratuitous, to say the least. It was something that they cooked up at a distance. And completely out of touch with the reality in South Africa. So that's the first point. The second is, I think it's going to take, as many others do, that it's going to take a bit of time, to put it mildly, for the magnitude of what they've been involved in and the magnitude of the impact to sink into senior managers, both internationally and in South Africa. I don't think they are anywhere near grappling with the reality as many of us would be doing in the South African context as well. In terms of a number, I think it's huge. Because ultimately you can say that in relation to the audits that they performed with the companies, and that varies from 7 years to 15 years, that any short-sightedness or oversight or refusal to actually cut through the fog and understand what was actually going on is the direct cause of allowing hundreds of billions of rands to leave South Africa into some foreign entity or place or the other. So you can start at the upper level and say there's a direct relationship between the lack of meticulous auditing and reporting on what you find in the auditing. Mm. Because remember, there's a provision for auditors that if you find irregular things, you've actually got to report them to IRBA. And those matters must, in fact, be investigated. Mm. Similarly, IRBA should take the public into confidence and indicate what checking have they done. Absolutely. In this regard as well. So I think for now, they have to bear the responsibility for the billions we've lost.
Final question on this, and then we're going to take our first break and go to another topic. You and I have spoken on other platforms before, Mr. Gordon, about the importance of institutions being robust enough to withstand the folly of the politicians in charge of those institutions at any moment in time in history. And so when this report landed, as woefully inadequate as it was in terms of lacking detail, it was nevertheless a good starting point for KPMG to begin the process of coming clean. And then I look, as a taxpayer, as a citizen, at the response of SARS, and it is mind-boggling. Because here you have a massive multinational company saying, we messed up. We're not going to give you the details, but we messed up. Hmm. And then you have SARS saying, how dare you confess to wrongdoing? You must have been flabbergasted by their response as well.
Yeah, no, I mean, again, if you put it in very simple terms, these were all instruments in the hands of the state capturers, right? Instruments that would either provide legitimacy, instruments that would either, in addition to legitimacy, cover up things that have actually been happening, but more importantly, instruments that could be used in the course of enabling under false premises enforcement agencies to act against people who in fact have no serious misdemeanor to account for, whereas those who do have something to account for constantly get away, as you repeatedly say in many of your shows as well. So the only thing we can say is that this is not going to be a permanent situation. This is not something that's going to last for 10 years. Sooner or later, the very conscious South Africans that we have of what is going on, from sometimes a very humble notion that there's right and wrong things happening, to very complex understandings of what connecting the dots means and what state capture means, South Africans are going to demand accountability at some stage. At some stage, people who have cause institutional destruction and decimated those institutions which are critical to our economy and our society and for future generations as well, must be held to account. And, you know, I can foresee in a couple of years' time the equivalent not necessarily of a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, but there has to be some kind of Truth and Something Commission where you own up to what you've been up to.
Truth and justice, perhaps. 25 minutes after 10, we're in conversation with former Finance Minister Pravin Gordhan. What questions have you got for him? You can use the hashtag Pravin on Eusebius or give us a call and engage him directly on 011-883-0702. That is our Johannesburg number. And in Cape Town on 021-446-0567. Plenty more to explore the state of leadership crises within the ANC. Can it yet rescue itself? Can it yet self-correct? Different views you heard last week on this platform. Some skepticism, but not excessive skepticism from former President Kgalema Motlanthe. A very different view from Dr. Makosi Khoza on the show. We'll ask Pravin what he thinks on that very important question for arguably the biggest social movement in the country.
Yes, good morning.
Yes, sir, go ahead.
Yes. I'm Joseph Makadene, father.
Hello.
Yes, I'm good, man. I'm good. As you know, I was part of the team South Africa to Europe, to England and the UK, talking to the investors. Then things happened on the 7th. Now, with what has happened, Brazil, and the ANC government, as well as the ruling party, whether it is in parliament, whether it is in their own NEC, it seems there's no strong view to say, let's get the rot out. I mean, what would be your view, Pravin, if there's a call to say ANC government must fall?
Okay, good question. Nice to the point. He is taking notes. Let's take another question very quickly. To the point, Alfred, what question do you want to put to him?
Yes, yes, how are you?
We will, Alfred. What's your question?
Yes, yes, yes. Kevin, how are you?
Hello, sir.
Good. Okay, do I get your views on the number of those contesting for the president? What's your view on that? And secondly, what's your view on the idea or proposal that the president made on the final day of the conference? I think it was the NGC that he made that whoever loses as a president,
yes,
ultimately becomes
should be deputizing.
And is he, which side is he supporting? Is it for NDZ or is it for SRC?
Lovely question there. Thanks, Alfred. I'll give him a chance to cook up an answer. In the meantime, it's 7 minutes before 11. Thank you for staying with us. We are this hour in conversation with former Finance Minister Pravin Gordhan. You had a couple of juicy questions there from our listeners.
Yes, Joseph, I must use this opportunity to introduce you as the big man in NACTU and the wonderful role that you played during 2016. And thank the country should thank you and your colleagues in the trade union movement for that. As far as the rot, as you point out, is concerned, I think what we must understand, as I see it, is that these things involve a vigorous struggle. That unless we fight against this, unless we expose the rot, as you correctly identify it, there's no quick answers to eliminating or diminishing corruption and the rot in our system. The second is that we must also understand that these are also systemic problems. So Eusebius, with his academic background, should actually add his voice to this as well, because when you have access to political office all over the world, you also have access to patronage. Mm. And that relationship between holding office, access to patronage, and the ability to distribute it, sometimes for good purposes, at other times for feeding one's friends and associates, is a phenomenon that has been around human beings for a long time. So I don't think this is about the ANC folding up. It is about those in the ANC, who I think are the vast majority, by the way, who have a principled stance on the issues of corruption, who have a principled stance on the values that Mr. Mandela and others have taught us over the years, but who also understand that there are a whole range of forces who are busy feeding themselves and their friends with state finances, and they must be exposed. So what's interesting is that some of the narratives that get put out, it hasn't happened in the last couple of weeks, I see, is that those who stand against corruption are described as the dissenters. In fact, the dissenters are those who are breaking away from the values of the ANC. And if anybody should be leaving the ANC, it's those who have broken the promise that the ANC and its leadership has made to South Africans.
But why can't the rest of them deal with those ones?
Because of the balance of power, on the one hand, but also...
So bluntly put, there are more bad apples than healthy apples in the NEC.
I don't think so. I think you'll have an interesting mix. I still think that more than 50% of the NEC wants to have the right things done. The recent discussion and decision on KZN is a case in point as well, where the right thing hopefully is going to come out of that process.
But why are they not winning the battle is what I'm asking. I mean, I put
because
this question...
Because of the link to state power, right? Part of overall state capture is the ability to maneuver state power in the service of your own objectives as opposed to in the national interest. And I think that's the discussion that we need to start
but what,
having.
Okay, but what I grapple with is how at least a numerical, if not a bigger majority of the NEC can be healthy apples rather than rotten apples, and yet they are not winning that battle. One of the most profound moments last week when former President Motlanthe addressed that question, he posited what I think was more than a hypothesis, because he obviously knows this. He says that part of the problem is that, especially with the expansion of cabinet and the size of cabinet over the years, that many NEC members, when they wear their hats as NEC members, wear them as employees of President Jacob Zuma, which makes it harder to rein President Jacob Zuma and his cronies in. That means that the numbers are in favor of the state capture lot rather than the other way around.
Now, I think that's a very astute point that Mr. Motlanthe has made, and one that needs to be taken into account. And I also think that the proposal he makes that cabinet ministers don't necessarily come from the NEC itself is an interesting one, which we need to experiment with for the next 5 years and see if it helps us to get the balance right. And if you're constantly watching, you know, over your shoulders, whether it is in respect of the job or other things that might actually matter to you, it does, I think, inhibit one in terms of taking the right stances at the right time. But I still believe that this is a struggle. It's a struggle that needs to take place on a vigorous basis. It's a struggle that's taking place every single day in different forms, in different arenas. And... and I want to link that to the second question, which is that in the course of the struggle, what is our historical challenge is whether we can restore the right values over the next 5 years, whether we can save the National Liberation Movement from what appears to be its historical fate, which is that after 20 years you lose currency, you lose confidence of the citizens, and you lose that ultimately.
We've seen that movie across the region.
So,
what's your prediction how it will play out in South Africa?
I think there's still hope for the ANC to actually go beyond that kind of phenomenon, because we are aware of what history dictates.
But Mr. Gordon, I have to challenge you here. You are deeply committed as someone on the left with your tradition and your political biography to paying attention to both the material and the objective facts and the objective conditions of the land. I mean, it's easy to say hope. The language of hope is a diet South Africans can no longer feed off. What is the objective facts that your language of hope is anchored in?
So hope, and it's a very good question, hope is linked to the capability and willingness to struggle. Hope doesn't come from nowhere. So if you have the capability and the willingness to recognize the problem, second, put up a struggle around the problem for what you consider to be right and what is universally considered to be right, then you begin to generate hope, because people see you doing the right things and they begin to support the right things that are actually happening. And that's why this proposition about whoever loses takes a second slot and so on is not a proposition that is actually going to work. Nor is the unity talk that is going on at the moment, without a solid foundation of principles. So in other words, how do we arrive at principled unity? is part of the challenge that our conversations over the next few months needs to take on as well.
You see, this brings me to the nub of the issue that I wanted to discuss with you about the state of the ANC and its ability or not to yet respond to that hope for self-correction. Because you and many others have accurately, lyrically, very tragically characterized a certain segment of the ANC leadership currently that does not seem to be deeply committed to constitutional supremacy, the rule of law, responsiveness, and beautiful, hopeful things like Batopela principles. Can the ANC survive their 20-year ominous historic period after which liberation movements typically go south if the rotten bit to the leadership is not excised?
Now, the rotten bit has to be excised. The opportunity exists in December to actually do so, number one. Number two, whilst the objective and material factors might point in a particular direction in terms of national liberation movements, there's a huge subjective factor there as well. So if you produce the right leadership, the right cadership, the right ideas that are compatible with what South Africa needs today and what the world requires today, as far as South Africa's place in the world is concerned, it is possible to take the ANC into another 10-year cycle where it does the right things, it corrects the mistakes of the past, it gets rid of the rot that is... as Joseph pointed out there at the moment, and puts the country on a much more hopeful path than where we are today. So I think there are many of us who are not about to give up in that particular regard. We'll do our best that as we can up to December.
Okay, well, time is running out. Let me ask you this question in terms of scenarios, right? I want to look you squarely in the eye so I can keep you honest. If you wake up on December the 21st, 2017, and the front pages have pictures of Dr. Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma as the next now elected African National Congress president, what happens in that scenario?
To what?
To your loyalty and narrative of hope.
No, I think it'll be significantly dimmed. And that is Alfred's second question, which is, where do I see that hope coming from? And I see it coming from a Ramaphosa campaign, both in terms of the personality, in terms of a potential team that can be put together, but also in terms of a potential program that can begin to emerge as well. And that I see as the only way in which we can save ourselves, if that's the predominant factor, within whatever arrangements that will need to be made. And let's not fool ourselves. As we get closer to December, all sorts of permutations will begin to emerge in terms of a top team within the ANC itself. Nobody can predict which way that is actually going to go. But I think what is key is, let's recall the principal basis upon which we want all of these things to happen. Let's recall again what our mission as the ANC is in terms of service to all 55 million people in South Africa, and what is our responsibility to unite a nation that has been rendered or torn apart for many, many decades on the one hand, and on the other hand, as you described very much earlier in the show, which is confronted with the levels of inequality, poverty, and unemployment that we actually have, which is going to require South Africans to do something absolutely extraordinary, pretty much like leading up to 1994, in order to cross some of those barriers that we have.
Okay, we need to take a break because I've had way too much water. I need a biology break as well. But I want to ask you this question before we do. I don't want to be a doomsday prophet. I know you are very optimistic South African. In that scenario, which is possible, and we don't know how likely it is because it depends on all sorts of things, like the auditing processes for branches being completely ethical and being done accurately, etc., etc. But cutting across all of that, in the event that Dr. Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma became president and her slate were to really just wipe the floor at the ANC elective conference, would you, as Mr. Gordon, be prepared to think of leaving the ANC in order to do country duty outside the ANC, Or can you only ever imagining dying as an ANC member? So Pravin Gordhan, I gave him a question there as I rushed off to the bathroom. 50 points, discuss. What is the answer?
Oh, the answer is very simple, that I haven't heard anything from that campaign yet which says that we are going to have a radically different South Africa to the one we've experienced over the last 5 or so years. And it's clear that one can't, certainly I can't, go through what we've just been through for the last couple of years, both in terms of the declining potential of this country and the kind of almost conscious efforts to place South Africa economically and otherwise in a position where the majority is constantly losing out. Mm. So we say we serve the people, but at the end of the day, we're just serving ourselves. So in those circumstances, people like myself must find some other role and some other way of continuing to contribute. But I also want to retire at some stage, you see. So let's see how that goes.
But it's an important question because the liberation movements across our region have incredibly important pride of place in the annals of anti-colonial struggle. And that also means that very often we lower the bar of what we, not what we expect of them, but how we respond to mistakes that they make once in government because of that psychosocial hold that they have over us. And I could hear Mr. Motlanthe wrestling with that last week. Dr. Makhosa has obviously managed to free herself psychologically from that. That's why I was asking the question. I was interested not so much in a quick new soundbite, but yeah. I was genuinely interested in how painful it must be for someone whose political identity, political family life is as important to your being as your actual friends and family in your life to even contemplate a political existence or role outside of the ANC. It can't be easy.
No, it can't be. And at the same time, one must be quite frank that, I mean, you know, as activists, we survived in difficult times, and there are people who've had much more difficult times than I have, only because you retain a sentiment of optimism and of hope and of the possibility of beating the worst of odds that one is actually confronted with. And the odds today are not as bad as what we faced in the past, so there must be hope that we can actually beat it. Mm. But at the same time, there has to be this realistic understanding that the future is going to be very different from the past.
Mm.
Its dynamics are different, the incentives in society are different, the economic pull to do the wrong things is actually quite strong as our society progresses. And therefore, you've got to constantly ask oneself, what is the right progressive thing to actually happen? Sure. How do you actually meet the human rights objectives that we've actually set for ourselves? Because if you put everything in the shape of just colors, flags, and T-shirts, that doesn't actually sometimes, or that it does sometimes detract from the core mission. The core mission is a decent life for all South Africans. Where we are reconciled with each other, we will have our conflicts from time to time, but the economy grows, more and more young people are competitive in the world, and have a job to look forward to, have families that they can look after, because that's the essence of politics at the end of the day.
Can we talk a little bit about Mr. Ramaphosa? I mean, we're running out of time, but what is the case for Mr. Ramaphosa? I almost feel sorry for you guys on the left. It's been 10 years since President Jacob Zuma was supported by a broad coalition of the left as the sort of anything but more of Thabo Mbeki camp. That investment has not yielded positive net present value returns. That is okay. You don't know how people will obviously play out after you've supported them. It's not a sin. As the objective conditions change, so you adjust your view of the horse that you had backed. But I think to myself, my goodness, history is repeating itself. And in a different way. Yeah, who would have thought you would have the likes of the South African Communist Party, Bladen Zamande, reluctantly, sure, backing this billionaire who back 20, 30 years ago was a trade union boss, but he's become a different animal. What is the case in favor of him, or is the support for Mr. Ramaphosa a case of anything but Nkosazana?
I don't think it's a negative. I think it's a positive. It's about, as you correctly put out, learning from our past experience and admitting our frailties as well in terms of backing horses on the basis of hope and on the basis that the next one will be better than the last one. There's no doubt about that. And one must admit that that's been a huge disappointment in terms of the expectations that everybody had of the current incumbent. In terms of the future, I think we must learn from that experience and make sure that it's not Ramaphosa the individual, it's also Ramaphosa and team, firstly. Secondly, it must be based on a clear program, which itself is based on ANC policy. Thirdly, it must be able to articulate what will the Ramaphosa team do differently from what might be happening at this point in time. And fourthly, what are the indicators that we would use that progress is in fact being made according to or in line with the kind of expectations that we've actually set.
Okay, but he would be CEO of SA Inc. if he were to be successful in his bid to get as far. What is so great about Cyril?
I think the kind of mix of experience that you've actually described stands in his favor. The trade union background, the UDF background. That's part of the experience. You learn from each of those things. There's no perfect human beings. There's no angels. Let's be frank about that. As long as one has the humility to learn, as long as one has the humility to admit one's mistakes and the ability to work with a collective that can steer you if you can't do it yourself, and that dynamic between a team and an individual is something that we learn about leaders in the corporate sector or in the political sector as well. So at the end of the day, I think it's that experience, but also the modernity that comes with that experience, which is what South Africa requires right now.
But he's often silent, Mr. Gordon. I mean, at best, I find him aloof, and at worst, he has yet to reckon with his own historical implication in, for example, Marikana. The guy hardly ever utters a word. Even at Magahung, you'll remember, none of us knew until the last moment whether he was even willing to deputize, and eventually he got elected without even articulating to conference why it is that he would be a great deputy president of the party and of the country. You have now spoken many more words about his candidature than he himself.
Well, I'm sure he's going to be your guest one of these days, and he'll explain himself and be able to give you the answers that you actually require, which I think is the best and the most authentic way in which you can get the answers to the question and get your listenership informed about where is this project going and what does it have to offer us as South Africa. Mm. But in the circumstances we find ourselves in, I think a better proposition is difficult to find.
We've got 2 minutes, 1 minute each for two last questions. Second last question. We often are very reductionist, and you hold us honest in the media. He was holding me honest as well about some short memories that we have as journalists very often. How important is it to not reduce South Africa's crises to the Gupta family and President Zuma, to be able to understand just how wide and how deep the crisis is beyond those names?
No, it's very important because we have serious structural issues, part of which come, as you would know from your own background, from our history. Part of it comes from the structure that we've inherited but still have in the economy, in society, and spatially as well. Some of those are compounded by the kind of contingencies that we have to deal with now. And that's where the pity is about our own situation. We have such huge, rich potential to be different, to continue to be